now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah!
See, a United States astral robot becomes a creature of death.
Oh. And babes.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain! Back to the House of Pain!
Hello everyone and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast. From classics to cults and all the cheese in between, the movies are B, the entertainment is grade A, and I'm your host Jason Jacquinetti, and I'm joined once again by my dad, Al Jacquinetti.
Hi Jay, how are you? I guess we can't get any further away from Harryhausen than Night of the Creeps.
Yeah, we're going to look at 1986 Night of the Creeps, and we'll do that right after this.
Finally here for Chris, Cindy, and JC. It's going to be the best night of their lives. But tonight is also the night of the creeps. From a world unknown comes a nightmare unimagined. First, they are under you, around you, on you. Inside you.
They get in through your mouth and you walk around while they incubate, even if you're dead.
They are a new breed of terror.
Freeze!
They are a different kind of horror.
Zombies, exploding heads, creepy crawlies.
We could have a little problem.
The creeps are taking over.
Good news and bad news, girls.
What?
The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
You have never had a night like this. Night of the Creeps. If you scream, you're dead.
Night of the Creeps was released in 1986. It was directed by Fred Decker. That name sounds familiar probably to Two True Freaks fans, because that's the guy who did Monster Squad. Fred Decker also wrote this, and as we know, he also wrote Monster Squad along with Shane Black. And Shane Black, let's talk about him for a second here, because, well, we know Fred Decker from Monster Squad. We know him from, obviously, Night of the Creeps, and he wrote and directed RoboCop 3, which I know a lot of people that kind of pretty much killed his career directing right now. He's been a writer since. But currently, what he's working on is the screenplay for 2018's The Predator, and that's with Shane Black. Now, some of you know that name, Shane Black, because that's Hawkins from the original Predator, and some of you also know that because he is directing the new Predator movie, which is really awesome. For those who are not familiar with Shane Black beyond that and think, I've never seen that guy act in a whole lot of anything, and he's usually a small bit part. He's actually in this movie in a very small part as an unnamed security, or one of the unnamed cops. You might recognize that because he did the recent movie Nice Guys, the one with Russell Crowe. He was the writer on that. He wrote Iron Man 3. He wrote the original Lethal Weapon. In fact, they were writing Lethal Weapon right when they were doing this. And Lethal Weapon is right around the same time. And then since then, all the Lethal Weapon movies are based on his characters. Obviously, also Monster Squad. And like I said, The Predator. And also the upcoming Doc Savage movies, which has no release date yet. So this movie was produced by Charles Gordon. It was distributed by TriStar Pictures and ran a running time about 88 minutes, came out on August 22nd. Its approximate box office is just over $590,000. Now, when they made Night of the Creeps, Fred Dekker had sold TriStar on the idea of making this, and they gave him the money. Before it even was released, he got them to agree to fund Monster Squad because of the advanced movies, the advanced screenings and stuff. It was so positive. They felt they had a big hit on their hands, and they said, yes, let's make Monster Squad. So it didn't make as much money as they were thinking, and Night of the Creeps really had a second life on home video. It's known for its one-liners, but it had a second life on home video. But it allowed Night of the Creeps allowed Monster Squad to be made. Monster Squad, as we know, is a movie that did not fare well in the theaters, but really has taken on a life of its own since then and has actually grown. And as the monster kids of the 80s have gotten older, that movie's become more and more a bigger thing. And this has been mentioned before, but Monster Squad itself pays a lot of homage to the old Universal monster mashups. Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, House of Dracula, House of Frankenstein, Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein. So Fred Dekker is one of those guys that if you don't know him, because he didn't direct a lot of movies, he has one episode of Tales from the Crypt and three movies. He's actually somebody who's had their fingers in a lot of things, and his relationship with Shane Black is one of those big things that in Hollywood it's kind of been important. He's not the name you're going to see every day, but if you're a genre fan, he's been there. Now the stars of this movie, Jason Lively. Now some of you recognize him as Rusty Griswold from National Lampoon's European Vacation, not from Vacation, and certainly not from Christmas Vacation. Now Vacation, that's Anthony Michael Hall. And Christmas Vacation is Jonathan Galecki, right? From Roseanne, and now he's from Big Bang Theory. But he was, Jason Lively was Rusty Griswold from the European Vacation. That's the one where they film them in the shower, and that gets around Europe. That's the lesser of the three. Steve Marshall didn't make many movies after this. Jill Whitlow, again, not many, but the other name that everyone remembers from here is Tom Atkins. Tom Atkins, we know him from, of course, Halloween 3. To me, one of the most underrated, quote-unquote, bad sequels, because Halloween 3 has nothing to do with Halloween. It's a really good movie if you called it Season of the Witch. It's not a very good movie when you call it Halloween 3. He's also in Escape from New York. I mean, Tom Atkins, he's in a lot of things. He's a guy, I think of him always being like the like Dennis Farina. Like, he's in things. Like, oh, I know that guy. I know that guy. He's like, and in fact, there's another one of those I know that guys.
Yeah, that's what I figured. When I was watching this movie, I hadn't seen it in a while, and I said, geez, all these guys, they look familiar, but yeah. I don't know who they are. Atkins, I said, I know him, and I knew him from Escape from New York.
Right, yeah. Well, that guy that I know in this movie is Dick Miller, right? Yes, Dick Miller is in the movie, what I'm saying, but that's the guy you know. And for anybody who listened to the Piranha podcast, you know, Dick Miller was the shyster in there, and Dick Miller's in a lot of movies. So, let's get started here. Okay, so our movie opens in 1959, and on a spacecraft, two aliens are trying to keep another alien from releasing some kind of experiment. Now, these aliens are short little aliens, and they're buck naked, and they got their tushy sticking out the whole way running around. So this would not have flown in really 1959, but it's all shot in that kind of, like, it's all in black and white, and it's supposed to look very campy. I think the movie itself plays that up to a max. So they release the pod thing.
Well, it's a cylinder.
It's a cylinder, yeah. I think this is the same opening Lilo and Stitch used. I'm just saying. I think that's the same opening. I think Disney ripped off this because Lilo and Stitch is at least a decade and whatever later. Anyway, so the cylinder is coming down to Earth. There's the sorority girl with her new fling after she broke up with the cop. And they're up on, like, the makeout place, and that's a scene right out of, isn't that I Married a Monster from Outer Space?
Yes, and also Invaders from Mars.
Right, yeah, but I'm saying, but they were sitting, and it's also The Blob.
The Blob,
it is
right,
The Blob. It is, exactly. So Fred Dekker knew what he was doing. He's paying homage to things, because remember, we pay homage, because we're not ripping them off, we're paying homage to it. And the meteor, they go chase the meteor. Now, what would not have been a 1959 movie is that there's a homicidal killer with an axe also on the loose. And so when the guy parks the car and leaves the girl, He goes running into the woods and he finds the cylinder, and that's when he gets the slug, because that's what's inside the cylinder are these slugs. It shoots down his throat, and he becomes a demon or zombie possessed. The axe murderer shows up and kills the girl. When they show us this, it's implied, and then they cut to present day, which at this time is 1986, which we know is now a long time from here.
Well, yeah, but the cop, who is the younger version of Tom, is he sees the axe murderer, and as the axe murderer turns around, as he says, "Raise your hands," as he turns around, his face...
Some of that's in his...
It's his mind.
Yeah.
But when the axe murderer turns around...
Because he does... That's later when he talks about chasing him down.
Yeah, and he says, I kill him already.
I think that's the whole point. He hunts him down later because he wasn't there to protect her. And I think that's one of the things we're going to talk about. I mean, obviously, when you look at the character of Ray Cameron, Detective Ray Cameron, that's Tom Atkins' character... Right. He's flawed throughout the entire movie, and his guilt is what causes him to do things. But yes, he doesn't kill them. It's all played for camp. It's really, again, in the 1950s and the early 60s, those drive-in kind of movies and whatever, they weren't played for camp. They were played because that's the way they were made. This is totally played up to be kind of silly. So we're talking like 27 years later, because it's 1986. Chris Romero... Yes, you've noticed so far, folks, that the last names are all horror directors, and everything's going to be a horror director. It's going to keep coming the whole time. And his friend, JC, now that's James Carpenter Hooper, because one name is not enough. You got to have two. They're looking for, they're trying to meet girls, and they're out, and it's Pledge Week. So during Pledge Week, Chris spots a girl whose name turns out to be Cynthia Cronenberg, because Corman University, where they go to school, and he's smitten with her, right? So he tries to get her attention by joining the fraternity. Now, he joins a fraternity. The one he goes to join is the one where her boyfriend, Brad, who's the prototypical 90s
jerk.
Absolute jerk. You know what I'm talking about. He's the kind of guy you just want to cave his face in when you see him, right? He's the head of that fraternity. So they tell them that to get in, they need to go steal a cadaver from the medical center. And they're going to drop it at the door of one of the other sororities, not the sorority that where his girlfriend's part of. So they go down into the basement, and the medical student there, he's young. That guy eventually becomes a character actor throughout, kind of thing. They go to steal the corpse. Well, what corpse is there? They find it's the guy who had the slug in his head. He's been on ice since 1959. He wakes up and grabs their arm. They run out of there. Now, I should mention, JC is on crutches because his legs are crippled. So he's going faster than Jason Lively is running, which is embarrassing beyond belief. And they're both so winded, they must have really ran because they're having a hard time delivering the line at the dorm room. Jason Lively's bright red and huffing. Now, he's got on a heavy sweater, and it's clearly not the fall when they're shooting this. Anyway, so meantime, now we see Detective Ray Cameron, who's clearly got something going on beyond the scope of just being a police detective. He's definitely kind of stuck in 1959. You get the feeling that the death of his ex-girlfriend there, when she's killed by the axe murderer, kind of throws him where he is. The car he drives is an old car from the 50s. He has one-liners throughout the whole thing. He's smarmy. He's a real smart-ass kind of thing. And the problem is that we kind of take on that there's something there. So they show up to where they have supposedly two bodies, right? Well, there's not two bodies. There's only one body because the body of the guy who was in Frozen now walks away. So he brings Chris and JC in for questioning. The corpse itself now makes its way back to the sorority house, and that's where it now interacts. It climbs up to Cynthia's window because that's where his girlfriend used to live. Taps on her window. Its head is split open, and all the slugs escape, right? So they find the body, and now they have the head is split open. So the first thing, what does he say? Could this have been caused by an axe? Because they've never caught the axe murderer. At this point, we don't know that the axe murderer is dead. All we know is that he never was caught. So the next day, the brothers confront JC and Chris and about how could they do this. And then they bring in the janitor, which I thought was always one of the funniest scenes because he really likes screaming like banshees. Like, he just loves that line. witnessed them running out, and they confessed that they broke in, but they didn't steal anything. So that night, the attendant that's dead, he kills the janitor. So it's just, there's people dying, but it's not over the top gore yet. Like, we're not at that point. So Cynthia attempts to convince Chris and JC that the attack was a zombie related attack, but they're kind of skeptical. So JC sees this as Chris's opportunity to get with Cynthia. So he, you know, buggers off and he goes to the bathroom. And that scene in the bathroom it's one of their famous scenes there. He's on the toilet, but his pants are up. And the slugs are all over the floor. So he burns one of the slugs, and when he goes to get out, he falls, and now he's on the ground. And you feel like, okay, and this goes to a POV shot, and the slug shoots down his throat. That's the last we see of JC in the actual movie, because Chris is with Cynthia. So they get her back to the right. So Detective Cameron he hears the discussion between Cynthia and Chris, right? And then Cameron winds up picking up Chris and taking him back. And that's when he admits that he killed the axe murderer and buried him in the lot behind the sorority house, which is now where the house mother. Not, don't call her den mother. That's different. The house mother's house is sitting on, right? So, of course, as soon as you hear that, they cut to this old woman who's fallen asleep. She looks like the one from the Clapper commercial. Like, she's in and out of sleep, and her dog's there. And you hear, bam, bam, the dog's looking around. And she wakes up and falls back asleep. Because what's on the TV is Plan 9 from Outer Space, 1959, the Ed Wood classic. And the whole point is it goes as the now the dead axe murderer who's in the ground. The slugs get into him, and he bursts out. And that's when the dog gets possessed and swallows the slug, and she gets murdered with an axe. They chopped her in a bunch of pieces, and that's when all the cops show up, of course, and the detectives with them. And that's when the coroner, who you made a good point about the coroner.
Yeah, if you watch the coroner and every one of his scenes, there's three or four of them. He's always eating a sandwich while he's got his hands in the corpse.
Yeah. Well, he comes and he goes, "If we bought a stretcher for every piece of her, we'd be here all week." Right. You know, kind of thing. It's like. It's those little throwaway lines, and I think people kind of look at it and go, oh, and they roll their eyes but that's the kind of lines that existed in those kind of movies back in the day. Like, not that, but trying to be kind of that smart, little different kind of thing.
Yeah, there was the one of the things that was here for a plot exposition, JC, when he actually leaves a note.
No, he leaves the tape recorder.
The tape recorder. Yeah. It's a note on a tape recorder.
Well, that's after
he's infested, and... It's before he goes from being before he becomes a zombie.
Full zombie, right?
But
yeah.
he says, "Look, I killed one. Fire kills the creeps." And then he's going to attempt. He's going to kill himself.
Well, yeah, because he said he was able to walk, and this is where you start feeling like the character JC doesn't do a whole lot in the beginning, except kind of be in the way. But you understand he has to be there at the end. And I think one thing Fred Dekker always understands in all his movies, because we're talking about, I mean. Whether you like RoboCop 3 or not or whatever, there are things in there. He purposely puts characters in to have a reason to be there. Everyone has a reason to be there. JC is there to give us that fire kills them, to show that it took over his whole body, so he had no control over his body. So someone who's unable to walk, to be able to walk, is a major thing.
Right.
And for him to then realize that he has to kill himself, so...
Well, the one thing about JC is that as the movie progresses, There are times when he overcompensates for his handicap by being a smart mouth.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in the beginning, sometimes you know he's crippled, so you have a little bit of sympathy. But the lines he comes out with sort of like takes you a little bit away from there. But as the movie goes on, and he becomes the catalyst for the end of the movie.
Right. It is
really at that point where his value comes in.
Right. So Chris goes back and he's able to finally get Cameron to actually come with him. And they go to the police armory, which is still, I mean, that scene's just great because he's down there. And it's Dick Miller behind there. I know we gave it away, Dick Miller's in the movie. That's where Dick Miller is. He's in the movie for about a minute and a half. And he plays the guy in the armory. But is there a better role for Dick Miller kind of thing in this movie? Like, he doesn't need to be, he's always got that role. He's Mr. Futterman from Gremlins, which a lot of people know.
Right.
He's that guy with that face. You know him. And when Tom Atkins loads the shotgun and points it at him, he goes, "Cause they need a flamethrower." And he's like, they're joking around. He's like, "All right, I need the requisition." He goes, "I don't have a requisition." So he puts the shotgun in his face. He's like, "All right." So you know he didn't kill him. He just gave him the flamethrower. Because In reality, think about this. When we talk about movies from the 50s and 60s and stuff like that, like they're like, oh, we need this, and somehow just go, someone goes in a car and pulls. You don't carry a flamethrower around. You have to go requisition that. Like, that's one of those things that, like, in the 60s, especially in those giant bug movies, you're like, we need this. They just go get things that, who has a bazooka in the car, you know? But, like, this is one of those things that kind of makes a nod there, and it's important. They get back to the house, and that's when we have all the frat brothers, because that's the night of the big dance. So Chris has got a tuxedo on, Cynthia's wearing her dress, and all of the frat brothers, which it is so not what a real frat is, but a stereotypical frat, right? They get on what a Greyhound bus, basically, right? And the funniest thing, and people always point to, like, oh, look, see how bad this is? The dog looks so fake. When, right. Like, but the worst effect is the bus driver's face. When they go to the shot, when he right before the bus, like, because the bus driver swerves to miss the now slug-infested dog, which looks completely like a puppet, because it is a puppet. And they go to that fake head of his where the eyes are actually bugged out of his head like he's in a freaking Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Yeah. The thing with the... just before the bus scene with the dog, there was maybe about a minute's worth of... and it's not plot exposition, but they're showing the girls getting ready and the guys getting ready for the formal.
Right, yeah.
The girls are getting ready, and every one of them in there, and again, this is every girl in
every
in
girl's
the,
naked.
Well, and they're all, it's a very sexy scene.
Yeah, they're all then, naked, then and they're all wearing like lingerie, and they're all taking their showers.
Then you go to the guys. And it's like who can snap a towel on somebody yeah. else's butt?
Well, but the whole point is they're making there is that I think Fred Decker did that on purpose. I think he's painting those broad strokes of what a sorority was. He's making fun of, even though maybe he wasn't necessarily making fun of, but he's making fun of all those movies that came in the early 80s. The movies that are all about like Animal House and Porky's and those kind of movies where it's all those sex comedies where he's making fun of that here. Like, here are all the girls. A girl sorority, right? And I've seriously only been in one girl sorority my entire life, and no one was naked, and no one was, it wasn't a whole bunch of people running around in their underwear, and none of them looked as good as any of these girls in this movie, right? And I've only been in one fraternity my entire life, and none of them looked like this, and it wasn't like that. But in the 80s, and that kind of like wink, wink, nod, nod kind of thing, this is what it was. He's playing it up. He wants you not to like the guys. You're supposed to hate them, so when they're dead, they're dead. Okay, great. So the bus... Flips over.
Yeah.
They die. The dog goes in and shoots slugs in there, right? That's what we're getting. Well, the best is that Brad shows up at that because Brad runs into the dog separately. And he shows up. So Cynthia comes down. She doesn't look at him. The sister who answers the door doesn't look. He's clearly dead. And I think that's one of the things, too, because you see that in movies. You're like, how does no one recognize he's dead? Well, in this kind of world, it's okay. Like, they're kind of like until their push comes to shove, everyone's kind of living in this fantasy world. So that's when Chris shows up with the flamethrower, with the detective, and he winds up shooting. Cameron winds up shooting Brad in the head, and Chris winds up burning all the slugs. And that's when he's standing outside with Cynthia, which starts off as one of the most, that end of the movie is one of the most iconic scenes from that. In fact, the most iconic scene happens right after it.
Yeah, well, the thing before that all happens, before they go and get the flamethrower, the detective is in his house, and it's Cameron.
Comes
and talks to him.
No, Chris is the kid. Cameron is the detective.
Okay. Chris comes in and talks to him, and they're having a conversation back and forth. But in the background, the detective has a bottle on the table with maybe half drank whiskey. But in the background, the stove door is wide open. And as they walk out, as they're going out to go get the zombies, the detective turns back and turns the gas off. So he was going to commit suicide.
Yeah, that's why he's got the door all taped.
Yeah.
And that's why when he's knocking the door, he finally doesn't answer it. He's going to kill himself. He's tortured the entire time. He's looking for any way to redeem himself. He can't find a way to redeem himself because they kill the axe murderer a second time. And he says, I've already killed you. As they unload, like, Predator style, like, every gun they got on this guy, right? The whole point is that he's seriously flawed, and I think that's what we see throughout the whole thing, is that he feels so guilty about not saving his girlfriend or ex-girlfriend in 1959. He never gets past that, and his whole entire life has been him trying to right that wrong or do something, and that's why he's always thrill me. Nothing can get me. That's his whole thing. Nothing can get him, right? So... We were saying, we're at the house. Chris is there and Cynthia, they're outside. Cynthia's manning the flamethrower, and Chris is manning the shotgun. Now, I have a shirt with that on there, right, from Fright Rags, which is an outstanding shirt. But inside the house, the best line, it's in our opening, it's the best line ever. The good news is your dates are here, and the girl goes, what's the bad news? They're dead.
Yep.
Haley loves that line. She says that all the time. I said, Haley, you can't say it so. You got to slow it down. She goes, all right, Dad, but it's a really good line. When I was watching this, and she's like, I know this movie. This is this line, and she knows that line. That line is famous because it's just so, like, Tom Atkins delivers it so well, and it's a really funny line because, like, you know, there's good news and bad news, girls. It's like, okay, like, what could this possibly be? They're dead. Well, yeah, it's just a blunt line, not delivered. It's a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's delivered well enough where you're like, okay, I get it. So, needless to say, it turns into shoot them in the head, burn the zombies, and they're trying to do this. Now, this is where the movie, the special effects budget was. This is where all the money is, because it's all the zombie exploding heads, all the stuff, it's all the flamethrowers, all that stuff's happening. Then they go into the shed. They're trapped, and they go into the worst constructed shed ever, mind you, because they're not even punching their way through. They're just slightly pushing, and the shed's falling apart.
Yeah, and the thing is, with when this is now at this point, he's out of shells
he's
for the shotgun,
shells, yeah.
and they can't turn the. I guess they're out of
The pilot went
the
out.
That's the pilot light.
Dick Miller says that when the pilot goes out, it's a pain to get back started, right. And he can't get the pilot started again on the.
Yeah.
The
thing. Well, now they're in the shed, and Cynthia is grabbed by the zombies, and I am a stickler for continuity. The last thing that Chris wants to hear is what she says. As they're dragging her out of the shed, she's yelling, Brad! Brad! Brad!
Yeah.
Brad at this point is dead.
Yeah, Brad has been dead for a while. Well, Brad was dead, and then they blew his head open and burned all the slugs in his head. So that's when he starts up the lawnmower.
Right.
And in an absolute nod. Now, for those people who have seen Dead Alive, there's a lawnmower scene in Dead Alive. Now, I don't know if you've never seen Dead Alive. That's one of Peter Jack kind of movie. It's the most insane thing ever. That's when he takes the lawnmower and he just mows down, like it's blood everywhere. This is not that, but he takes the lawnmower and runs the zombie over with the lawnmower. And that's the kid from the beginning, that's Steve or whatever his name, the kid with the unibrow.
Right.
That's the one he runs over with the lawnmower. So, needless to say, they see all the slugs go into the basement. And he goes, what's in the basement? She goes, I don't know, boxes, books, someone's science experiment. Now, they never expand upon what the science experiment ever was, but clearly whatever's there, they're all going to it, all the slugs. So you're assuming it must be something along the lines of doing experiments with some kind of animal or something that they can feed on. So there's just a mass in the corner of the
thousands
slugs
of them.
Yeah, and they're sticking off like daggers. And we see at that point Detective Cameron's got his mouth covered with the duct tape. He has the duct tape on, so they get in through your mouth. They have never shown. It's not like it's Wrath of Khan where they're going through the ear with the thing. The only way they're getting in, it's not Dreamcatcher where they're going up the other end.
Right.
You know, it's the only way they're getting in is through the mouth. So he's down there and he's pouring. He's got a thing of gasoline. Right. He's gonna sacrifice himself to save everybody. And that's when they get down there, and the flamethrower won't work because they would have burned them all. So he takes the tape off and starts counting. And goes 20. 19, and they finally get the hint that they need to leave.
Right.
So they run out of the house, and you see is the he catches the one that shoots at him. Like he catches it, and he kills that one. And right before he turns the gas on, right, and right before he lights the lighter, they all shoot at him, right. And that's when outside Chris is out there, goes, Detective, thrill me, which is the other catch line from this movie. The thrill me is actually said by Detective Cameron, I think 5 or 6 times in the movie, but it's when Chris delivers the line outside, that's the line everyone remembers, because then the house explodes, right? And this is what leads to the two different endings. Now, the original ending, which is on the director's cut, which is the ending I like, has them, you know, they're standing out there, there's the fire department, everyone's outside, the house blew up, a lot of dead people, but everyone's there, because nothing people like more than a house fire, and that's when you see Chris and Cynthia kiss. And then they cut to the other street where Detective Cameron is walking, a burnt hull of him, and he's walking and walking, and he falls, and his head cracks open, and all the slugs go into the cemetery. And that's when we get giant spotlight in the cemetery. And who's back? The aliens, and they're searching for them. And that was a lot of money they spent on that shot. I mean, this movie didn't have a huge budget. That's a lot of money on that effect shot of the spacecraft where they're searching for them. That was the original ending. It didn't test well. I'm going to say it didn't test well with audiences. I think it didn't test well with executives. I think they wanted more of an open ending. Maybe they wanted people to kind of forget the... I think they wanted people to forget the aliens. So, the other ending, which is what they went with in the movie theater, is the dog shows up and she says, "Hey," whatever the dog's name is, and then the dog opens his mouth and the slug shoots out. I'm thinking what's happening here, and I'm not saying it was necessarily test audience that didn't like that ending. I think they might have liked that. What we got there was the original ending is much more kind of a throwback ending. Like there's aliens and it's much bigger. It's a grander ending. The ending you got there, I felt was like a 1980s ending. Like, we're not done yet, you know, kind of thing. It's going to be a sequel. Like, it didn't need a lot. And for some reason, that's what they went. And originally, you couldn't get, that was the only ending that ever that people saw. There was bootlegs going around for a long, long time with both endings on it and stuff. In fact, this movie wasn't available for a very, very long time, except maybe on VHS, but everyone's on DVD for a while.
Yeah, what I found with the dog ending, and I'm calling it the dog ending, is that the Cynthia would be the last person that should get the slug, because that will not open up any kind of a sequel, at least in my opinion. When you have the spaceship coming down looking for either the cylinder or escape slugs, that then opens up, like Jason said, a myriad of possibilities for a sequel. But again, if you kill the lead love interest in the story, why would anybody want to go back to see more slugs? You'd have to introduce a whole new set of characters.
Right.
So,
well, part of me wonders, because this, again, like I said, Decker had sold this story to them and directed it and did everything he's going to do for this movie. And they shot all this and they gave him the money. And that got a Monster Squad. A Monster Squad they thought was going to be another hit. This one didn't turn out to be the hit they thought it was going to be a way bigger hit than they thought they had. Because that's the way it came out at the end of August. They were hoping to get that summer money, the end of the summer kind of, you know, kids kind of going to the show. I don't know. I'm not 100% sure. I've never seen anywhere it says why they changed it, just that it did change. So, a couple of things here I just want to throw out. There's, obviously, we talked about the Plan 9 from outer space. On the wall, there's graffiti. There's two sets of graffiti that are very important in this movie. The first set of graffiti is when JC's in the bathroom, and it says, "Go Monster Squad" on the wall. Monster Squad is in this movie. I think it's hard. It's going to be very hard for Fred Decker ever to do anything and people not say, "Remember Monster Squad?" Like, yeah, everyone remembers Monster Squad. And that's on the wall. And, of course, that's the next movie. He actually had that script already done. Him and Shane Black working on it, like we said. You know, everyone's named for everything. This movie was actually shot... the other piece of graffiti, real quick. It says, "Striper Rules." Right? Striper is the name of a band. And Kyle Sweet was the makeup artist, and her relationship with her future husband, the front man from Striper, Michael Sweet, was why it's on the wall.
Yeah.
Most of this movie was shot in an old Woolworth department store that was abandoned. They turned it into a soundstage and they shot most of it in there. Greg Nicotero and Howard Berger, the two of the guys from K&B Effects, they're two of the zombies in the background, right? Okay, the tool shed scene, it was shot after principal shooting had wrapped, and they had a rough cut that was shown to test audiences, and several people thought the picture needed more action, so they put it in. That's why they probably didn't catch Gary Colin and Brad. I knew I saw something about it, but I didn't remember what it was. Night of the Creeps, I saw this and I had to grab it, was not the only script that Fred Decker had that included zombies attacking humans. Around 88, him and Shane Black, of course, worked together at writing a final draft for a script titled Shadow Company. It was actually the first script that Black wrote back in 84, a year before his first draft of Lethal Weapon. The script was to be an action horror film about a group of U.S. Special Forces soldiers who died during Vietnam, and years later, after their bodies are brought back the soldiers who were members of a secret army experiment rise up from the graves as rotting, unstoppable zombies. The zombie soldiers would have raided the army for a nearby army base and then possessed to destroy the town, or proceeded, excuse me, to destroy the town in which they were buried, killing everyone in it and wiping it off the ground during Christmas night. The movie was going to be directed by John Carpenter sometime in 89, produced by Walter Hill, who also, I guess, worked on some of the script rewrites, supposed to star Kurt Russell, but it was never made, right? Sounds a lot like Universal Soldier kind of idea that came in the 90s. Jean-Claude Van Damme and Dolph Lundgren. And then Universal Soldier made a whole bunch of other movies that are just way worse than that. Kind of sounds a little familiar to that. But again, to think that's 84. That's before Chud 2, which has the army guys trying to use it. It's kind of using the ideas that we saw later in Return of the Living Dead Part 3 when they're trying to make the zombies into the killing machines. It's, I mean, again, ideas are out there and whatever. Would that have been really cool? Another John Carpenter movie starring Russell, Kurt Russell? Yes, I will take that because, let's face it, all the other ones have been good, you know, kind of thing. So that's good to go. Okay. One thing about the endings. The Cameron ending where his head splits open, that was used on TV a bunch because the movie ran too short. So that's the end. They put that ending back in as the TV ending to make the movie run enough time to fit its time slot, because it actually runs like a minute or whatever. It's just that little bit of time. That's what they used. And the dog shooting a slug got cut. Yeah. So, I mean, there's not much more to say about that. I mean, the movie is what it is. If you've never seen Night of the Creeps, I think you're missing out. I love this movie. It's not Monster Squad, you know, kind of thing, but it's definitely a movie that I think is up there. In the world of as Paul Spataro would say, is it Jaws? Well, I think it's a Jaws 2, if you understand what that means, folks. If you listen to Paul's podcast, and you should be listening to Paul's podcast because it's funny, right? And it's insightful. But it's to me, it's a Jaws 2, but a high Jaws 2, a close to the Jaws 1 kind of level, if you get what I'm saying. So let's just throw this out there, because you know I'm the guy who always tells you to go to the Two True Freaks website, click on the Amazon link, rent it on Amazon Video for $3.99, that's fine. Blu-ray, $9.49. DVD, $9.99. Unless you don't have a Blu-ray player, buy the Blu-ray. It's beautiful. It's cleaned up. It's as crisp as you're going to get. It looks great. It's super reasonably priced. I mean, to me, that's, you know, $10. I mean, I spend more than $10 on things all the time that are way worse than that. If you haven't seen this movie, it's worth checking out. To me, this is a movie that, again, this is one that we used to watch, and I would say a lot, because it wasn't available for a very long time, and I actually had a bootleg I got at Chiller, at the Chiller convention. I mean, gotta be, you know, almost 20 years ago now, right? But that was the only way you got it, and it was taken, and it had both versions. It had both the theatrical version and the TV version, they called it the director's cut. Now it's much, that was an old tape source, it was dirty, it was ever. Now it looks great, it looks clean. You can appreciate the special effects work. The zombies look good. I mean, they're not, oh my God, they're not blowing you away, but they're solid, good zombies, especially for the 80s. The slug work is really good. They don't appear fake. They definitely appear wet. I know, Haley, that's a big thing with models, with Haley. It's, can you make this look wet? And that's one of the things. So it's a solid, good movie, and I think this is a movie that around Halloween time will pop up now and then. Sometimes it used to be called, they used to have... not Chiller. What's the name of the... I'm trying to remember the name of the channel. They used to have... It was like Horror on Demand or one of those things. They would show this. This sometimes pops up on TV. And Impact, which is a... I don't know if they even have a channel, but they're an on-demand thing like on your cable. They used to love showing this in October. This is an October movie. Even though it came out in August. This is an October movie.
Yeah. To tell you the truth, as I said, I hadn't remembered this movie at all. The name sounded familiar, but I couldn't place it. And when Jason asked me to watch it so that we could comment on it, I said, this is a good movie. It's, you know, it's not overly long at 80 something minutes.
88
minutes. It goes by quick. It's not like you're sitting there watching, Cleopatra for 4 hours.
Yeah.
But as I said, this is a really good movie, and it's worth your while to see it.
Yeah, and the thing is too, I know some of you, some of the things I've heard. Just talking with guys, they said, oh, it's great, and you and your dad are talking about Harryhausen and stuff, but you gotta remember, B-movies don't just have to be things from the 50s and 60s. This is a B-movie. This is no A-picture, folks. This is a B-movie. It's a fun B-movie. There is some nudity. There is a little bit of swearing, so for maybe those of you who are maybe worried about your younger child seeing this stuff, it's just be forewarned. They do use a few bad words here and there, and there is some nudity, but there's not a ton of gore. Like, I'm thinking, this is 86. What else came out in 86? The Fly. Cronenberg's The Fly. Is there any seriously movie, I think, from 86 that might have more blood and gore and just...
Disgusting.
Yeah. I mean, I love The Fly. Don't get me wrong. Cronenberg's Fly, A-picture. It's kind of a B-movie idea, but on an A-picture budget, and he definitely makes body horror. If you want to hear more about that, go to The Vault. Check out, we talked about Videodrome. Videodrome might be the only other movie I've seen around that time that might be more body horror than The Fly. But this is a great movie. It's a fun watch. If you're of the, like my brother, age that we are in our mid-30s, your early 40s, this might be one you saw when you were a kid. It's a video store kind of movie. It's one of those you go in, you think, oh, let's get this movie. It looks cool. So that's about it for Night of the Creeps. So what's up next? Now, I know usually you guys are like, there's one a month, and we did a special from Jersey Fest, which I got a lot of positive feedback on, because it was short, I think, and we kind of just, because there wasn't a whole lot, there's nothing really to talk, it's not a movie, it's our lives. So we're going to come up with an All Hallows Eve special. Now, when we talked about this, what movie could we do? We went through a litany of movies, Chud, and things like and just like real gross out horror, and like, and then I said,
They Live,
and stuff like that. We're like, but what, to me, what says Halloween? Well, besides maybe Witch's Night Out, which is a cartoon, and the Disney Halloween specials, which were just, you know, like the ghost and whatever, and those are not B movies, those are cartoons from Disney, which is, Disney doesn't have make B anything, and Witch's Night Out, which is a great little cartoon, but kind of, it's a cartoon from TV. So we thought about, how about some Universal horrors? Now, let's be honest here, Universal horrors, we're not talking, you know, Wolfman, Frankenstein, Dracula, The Mummy, Creature Black Lagoon, those are their main pictures. You got to be going off of them when those things were a little older, and now they're trying to make money off them. So we're going to be doing our All Hallows Eve special on House of Frankenstein. Yes, the movie that comes after Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, and the one before House of Dracula, and of course before Abbott Costello Meets Frankenstein, which is a favorite on the Two True Freaks network. So that'll be the next time you hear us coming together for that. We got some stuff coming up in the next few months. We're trying to make sure we're going to be, you know, staying with our stuff, you know, our prime area, you know, kind of thing. But we're dipping back into the 40s here, just so we went a little forward into the 80s. And we're trying to give you guys stuff, you know, that you want to hear. Now, if you want to write into the show, of course, send me an email, botsbugsbabespodcast@gmail.com. It's all in the outro. If you have feedback on this, something to ask my dad, ask me, you know, whatever, send us feedback so we can respond to it, and we'll read it on the air, and we'll get out, and the feedback we've been getting, especially from our loyal listeners, has really helped us kind of pick out the movies we're going with and kind of change up the format so it works a little better, and things, it's, you know, it's all part of give and take. So I think we're good to go on Night of the Creeps. I think we're getting ready to, you know, maybe do some House of Franks, then go back to Hallowed Antiquities in 1945.
Hallowed Antiquities. The line from Gladiator.
Yeah. Luke loves saying that. That is, Luke says that back in Hallowed Antiquity of 1987, you know, kind of things like that. So, all right, folks, that about does it. Keep those cards and letters coming, and keep watching the skies.
I have good news and bad news for you girls. Good news, your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag, The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram,
find me under my name, Jason Jacquinetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Jacquinetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?